We all carry family stories. Genealogy Roadshow co-host Kenyatta Barra uses DNA and historic documentation to sort ancestral facts from fictions.
Uncovering your ancestry and your family history really connects you to the people that came before you. So it gives you a sense of togetherness.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on Second Thought Talks with Barry about the Family Tree Toolkit, her guide to doing your own genealogical research, and how she's climbed the branches of her own family tree. Plus an Amazon hiring spree and other reasons why thousands waited in a mile-long line to attend a recent Macon job fair.
Well, it was a great experience for the city of Macon. It was a good opportunity for everybody to come out here and get a job, because it's a struggle out here, man.
With unemployment at record lows, why are so many Georgians looking for work? All that and more coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Trump administration is holding public hearings starting today about proposed new tariffs that could be slapped on billions of dollars of Chinese imports. President Trump has already put about $250 billion of Chinese goods under tariffs. Analysts warn more tariffs could harm the U.S. retail industry. Iran says it could exceed limits on its stockpile of low-enriched nuclear fuel in the next 10 days. This marks the latest rollback in Iran's commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. NPR's Peter Kenyon notes President Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the deal.
A spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says Iran will breach the limits on its low-enriched uranium set under the nuclear agreement. The announcement, carried by Iranian state TV, came at a news conference at Iran's Arak heavy water facility. Low-enriched uranium is primarily used for peaceful purposes, such as generating electricity. If enriched to high levels, it could be used in a nuclear warhead. The declaration by Iran comes amid ongoing tensions in the Persian Gulf, where Tehran and Washington have traded accusations about recent attacks that damaged two tankers. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Chinese state media is reporting President Xi Jinping will visit North Korea Thursday. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai it will be a two-day trip.
State news site Xinhua announced the upcoming visit, saying Xi will visit Pyongyang at the invitation of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It will be the first visit there by a Chinese president in more than a decade. His decision to accept Kim's invitation may indicate that China is taking a more hawkish approach with the U.S. as the trade war between the world's two largest economies drags on.
NPR's Rob Schmitz. The court-martial for a Navy SEAL accused of war crimes gets underway this week. From member station KPBS in San Diego, Steve Walsh reports.
SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher is accused of killing a wounded teenage ISIS fighter in his custody and bragging about it in a text message sent to fellow SEALs. Prosecutors are expected to present a photo of Gallagher posing with the body of the dead fighter. Gallagher has been linked to a list of potential pardons being considered by President Trump. The case took a twist when the judge removed the lead prosecutor after it was revealed he had sent an email tracker to members of the defense team and a reporter to find the source of media leaks. Among the people scheduled to testify are seven of Gallagher's SEAL teammates. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
A senior official with aircraft maker Boeing says the company is sorry for the loss of lives in the crashes of two Boeing 737 MAX jets in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Meanwhile, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg also says the aircraft maker should have been more transparent about a safety light that was not working as designed in the jets. Boeing is also working on a software update that will allow pilots to more easily control their aircraft. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Vatican has released a document that says the Catholic Church will open debate on whether older married men can serve as priests in remote parts of the Amazon. The proposal comes ahead of an October meeting of South American bishops in the Amazon region. The Vatican document also calls for a discussion of some kind of official ministry for women in the same area. It did not elaborate. The church says Catholics in isolated communities on the Amazon go for months without being able to celebrate Mass. In India, a heat wave killed several dozen people over the weekend. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Mumbai the monsoon is bringing relief to some areas, but the rains are delayed elsewhere.
Temperatures have reached 122 degrees in parts of northern India. Authorities are delivering water in tankers to parched villages under police guard. Fights have broken out among thirsty neighbors in hours-long lines. At least one man was beaten to death in the south. IT companies are asking employees to work from home or bring their own drinking water. Doctors' summer vacations have been canceled. This is the new normal, though, in India's increasingly crowded and already hot cities. Air conditioner sales are on the rise for those who can afford them. A Stanford University study says global warming has slowed India's economy by 31%. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
In World Cup soccer action, the U.S. defeated Chile on Sunday 3-0 in Paris. The U.S. is now able to advance to the knockout round of the Women's World Cup, but first it will have its final game of group play against Sweden on Thursday. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from iDrive, maker of remote PC, providing real-time access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Imagine 3,500 job seekers standing in a mile-long line, waiting for hours to get into a job fair. Is this a scene from the Great Depression when Bing Crosby's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime was a hit? Nope. June 2019, the Anderson Conference Center in Macon, a city and state with low unemployment rates. The turnout was a surprise to both job seekers and to organizers and to us. So we assigned On Second Thought intern Jake Troyer to investigate. He connected us with Stephen Adams, executive director of the Macon-Bibb County Industrial Authority. That's the entity charged with attracting new businesses and employers to Macon. And he's on the line from our bureau there. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And to talk employment numbers, we're joined in studio by Alex Carmadel. He's senior policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, dedicated to nonprofit, nonpartisan research and analysis. Alex, great to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
All right, let's start with you, Stephen. There was obviously a huge demand for the job fair. What kind of employers were there to draw that kind of turnout?
Well, we recognized it would be good to try to have an industry-specific job fair, and so we focused on the logistics industry, obviously with Amazon getting closer and closer to their day one and their hiring process. We thought it would be appropriate to invite our other logistics industry partners. So we had people there from Coca-Cola, from McLean, from Kohl's. Just some of our distribution center operators, but also we have, some of our manufacturers have a logistics piece of their industry, and so we invited some of our manufacturers to join us as well.
I'm not exactly clear on what logistics industry means.
Well, that is, I think the easiest way to describe it from a consumer's perspective is that when you go on Amazon and click to have that order shipped to your house in less than a day, how does that happen? How does it get to you? And that's where the logistics industry comes into play.
All right. So Amazon, obviously a big draw for job seekers. We all remember the heated competition to land Amazon's second headquarters, or H2Q. Winning city was not Macon, by the way. So what kinds of jobs or facilities does the tech giant have in Macon?
Well, it's funny, when we were first working this project, it was confidential, as most of the projects we work are, and it started as a real estate search. For the logistics industry, the location is very important. And so while we were about halfway through this process, Amazon announced that they would be doing what was referred to as HQ2. And obviously it caught our attention, and we looked closer into it. And if you looked at the RFP that they put out, there were some very specific guidelines for which most cities of Macon size were well outside of those parameters. So we continued to work the project that was available to us, which was the now 1 million square foot fulfillment center. But this is they will be hiring from scratch. I mean, they're right now they have brought in a senior operations manager from one of their other facilities to get this branch up and running, but they will be hiring everything from janitors all the way to the manager levels, and this includes equipment operators, stockers, pickers, packers, material handlers, forklift operators, CDL drivers. I mean, it's the whole gamut.
And Macon, of course, great interstate infrastructure, college students there, workforce ready. Alex, unemployment rates have been consistently declining. As of March 2019, Bureau of Labor Statistics has Georgia's unemployment rate at 3.9%. But here we have thousands of people looking for work. What do you see in those numbers?
Yeah, so the unemployment rate is a quirky way to really understand our economy. Given the story that we're talking about today about the job fair, it's more appropriate to think about labor force participation, which also includes folks who are in the workforce and those who are actively seeking jobs. And that rate captures folks who are seeking work, but also are dealing with a lot of barriers and cycling in and out of job fairs and the unemployment line because they may be funneled into work that may only provide part-time wages or part-time hours. Perhaps doesn't provide the quality supports like paid leave, sufficient health care services, things like that, which encourages folks or motivates folks to kind of reconsider their current job status and consider new opportunities and new jobs.
So this is not the only, unemployment is not the only statistic to measure jobs. There's
That's right.
also underemployment. What's the distinction between those two?
Yeah, so underemployment can be looked at as jobs that don't necessarily match an individual's skills or education. So somebody being completely overqualified for a job that doesn't necessarily require a bachelor's degree or higher, which is seemingly becoming a larger proportion of our jobs landscape in Georgia. But it also includes those jobs that, again, don't provide the quality and the support for folks to sustain themselves and their families, that don't necessarily lead to dignity in work that we hear often talked about in Georgia.
So it sounds like we have a lot of skilled workers who are doing work that is, that's below their skill level.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So, Stephen, was the number of people in attendance a surprise to you?
It was. I mean, I think we expected what we've come to term as the Amazon effect. Is, you know, hindsight is 20/20 looking back on it. But we had talked with several potential facilities and talked to Anderson Goodwill Conference Center, and they had hosted job fairs in the past, and I think their record was 1,500 people. And so we were kind of thinking, all right, that's fair to expect that. And very early that morning, we recognized that it was going to be a large crowd, and we worked to accommodate. And, you know, I know there were a lot of people that are waiting in the long lines, and it was hot out there, and we did everything we could to accommodate. But to me, I think that is definitely an indicator that people are hungry and they're looking for more opportunities. And that's really where I see our role is to, you know, try to identify companies that are a good fit for our community and provide more opportunities, because at the end of the day, I think a lot of times we have found that the more opportunities there are out there, the more it requires employers to be more competitive with their pay scale and their benefits that they offer.
What were the numbers in the end? How many people attended?
We're ballparking over 3,500 people.
Wow. So we're talking with Stephen Adams. He's executive director of the Macon-Bibb Industrial Authority. Also with us, Alex Carmadel. He's senior policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. So, Stephen, what kind of workers were employers looking for? Were there specific skill sets?
Again, just speaking to some of the titles and the type of jobs they were trying to hire were those equipment operators and CDL drivers, forklift operators, material handlers. And, you know, the skill set a lot of times is, you know, they're looking for people who are gonna come in, and they're going to come in on time. And, you know, a lot of these skills are trained on the job. So there's on-the-job training programs. There's also, a lot of our employers work closely with our higher education entities, specifically the technical college as well as the local K-12 career academy, to try to develop those skill sets earlier on and develop those pipelines.
So, Alex, when we're talking about unemployment and underemployment, what I'm hearing from Stephen is, and from you also, you know, this sort of gap between skilled workers, non-skilled workers, and what's needed in between. What do we think of the underlying causes of that?
Sure. So I think there is a big disconnect between those opportunities that are actually providing substantial support in order to get people up the rungs of the economic ladder and the current opportunities that exist throughout the state of Georgia. A lot of the unemployment figures and the economic growth figures that we're seeing really are nestled around the Atlanta area, and a lot of that growth leaves out the rest of the state. And we're starting to see that we're upskilling and we're growing a workforce that is only prepared to take on opportunities in the metro Atlanta, the highly economic mobile center of our state versus in other parts of the state. So making sure that we're tailoring those investments and partnering with employers and luring businesses and employers to places like Macon-Bibb, like in Southwest Georgia too, or along the coast like Savannah and Chatham County, is a huge, would provide huge benefits in terms of closing those gaps.
So that's where you come in, and policy researchers like you, and you report to businesses, you report on research to lawmakers shape policy. When you see politicians trumpeting a low unemployment rate, are they missing something?
Yeah, I'm say that a little enthusiastically because I feel like a lot of folks are shouting into the void, saying that this is not the necessary metric that we should be thinking about when we're, you know, for lack of a better phrase, selling our state. You know, being the number one place to do business should ask us or want us to ask questions about who is missing out on the growth and the opportunity. Because at this current state, it's not the businesses, it's the people who are the unemployed, the underemployed, and so on and so forth. So when I think of the unemployment rate, and this is just one example, Georgia's unemployment rate for the state, you mentioned, is about 3.9%. When you look, disaggregate that along lines of race, ethnicity, and gender, you see massive gaps between people of color and white individuals in the state. And those gaps have grown over time. So you also see that in terms of wages. So the unemployment rate has actually declined, but we're seeing that our wages have actually not rebounded since the recession. So a lot of the job growth has been concentrated in opportunities that don't necessarily would be considered economic mobility opportunities. So those are the kind of things that we want to encourage our lawmakers to consider when they're, you know, partnering with employers. I think Stephen brings up a great point about making sure that the pay is competitive and employers are bought into that idea, specifically for regions that are outside of the metro Atlanta area.
Well, what do you think of that, Stephen? Is this a conversation that you have with your colleagues there at the Macon-Bibb Industrial Authority?
I do, and I'm part of the Georgia Economic Developers Association, where a lot of these conversations are had. And you know, I think Alex makes a lot of great points in that, you know, we work very closely with the Georgia Department of Economic Development, which, as he said, has been gotten us ranked as the number one state to do business in, which that opens up an incredible amount of doors. You know, in our business, it's really trying to highlight the available assets, and I think that's the reason we've gotten that designation, is because of the assets that we have in the state. But it's very competitive, and I think Alex makes a good point also about the nature in which a lot of employers do look in and around Atlanta, and it's very competitive outside of Atlanta, and we work very hard to showcase our assets. And you know, while I know this morning we're talking about what came about with the Amazon job fair, but I think it's also important to point out that a lot of our successes over the last few years have also included the aerospace industry and the manufacturing industry, where there are, you know, very strong head of household type jobs, where there's a lot of mobility for growth opportunities there. And you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, just in being in this industry and getting to have some of the conversations I have with people that have been in these industries for a long time, I talk to a lot of people that have started you know, on the floor working there, and now they're the vice presidents or the general managers. And so while, yes, I understand that sometimes these entry-level jobs, it may not be right where they want, but it's an opportunity, and it's a start in getting somewhere where you may want to go to.
Alex, you're nodding here. What are you hearing?
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I wanted to lift up something that the state is doing that I know that the Georgia Department of Economic Development has been really great on championing and supporting, which is Georgia Quick Start, which is a great example of a partnership between the state and employers that enables or actually provides a workforce, a ready and equipped workforce, to employers that are looking to locate to Georgia. I think that critical investments in programs like that are so key, because what it does is it basically affirms or confirms that whenever a business is looking to relocate to Georgia, that we are ready and equipped to provide a sustained workforce for that industry. And pairing that type of strategy with the long-term strategic industries like logistics, like healthcare, like aerospace, those high demand career industries, is going to be so critically important for Georgia's future.
Alex Carmadel, from the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And to you, Stephen Adams, director of the Macon-Bibb County Industrial Authority, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, here's a little fun fact in training. This segment was produced by an On Second Thought intern, and it's based on reporting from two GPB interns in Macon. So thanks to Jake Troyer, Mariana Bacallo, and to Emily Rose Thorne for their work on this. Stay with us. Go back in time with Kenyatta Berry after the break. The co-host of PBS's Genealogy Roadshow stops by to talk about finding your roots. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. And we are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Recreational genetics is a thing. An estimated 26 million people worldwide have dug into their ancestry with the help of at-home DNA kits like Ancestry.com or 23andMe. But finding your family story requires more than learning ethnic percentages from a DNA swab. And that's where genealogist Kenyatta Berry comes in. You may have seen her on PBS's Genealogy Roadshow.
Is this famous Bugs Roberts of St. Louis the same as your great-grandfather, Daddy Bugs Roberts? So let's look at the second part of that article we had. One of the big things it mentions is who his surviving family is.
Oh.
Tell me if you recognize a name.
Dolores, your great-grandmother. Oh.
Kenyatta is here for the Atlanta History Center's Juneteenth celebration and joins us to talk about the Family Tree Toolkit. It's her new book detailing the multiple websites and sources for building out the roots and branches of your family tree, and joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I'm thinking of Ancestry.com, FamilySearch.com, Find My Past, all these websites. They've sunk millions of dollars into making records available and DNA tests, of course, flourishing. What do you think is behind this boom in genealogical research?
Well, I think a couple of things are behind the boom. One is genealogy TV. It's a genre. You have Genealogy Roadshow, Finding Your Roots, Who Do You Think You Are, Relative Race. So all of these shows have really put genealogy in the forefront, and people are very interested in understanding their family history. And DNA is something that is often on sale and is affordable.
Good marketing.
And Ancestry and 23andMe do put a lot of money into marketing those DNA tests. So I think we've seen it become more accessible. And with records being available online, it's much easier for people to find their family history.
So they're finding their family history, but it often counters the stories they've told about their families. That's something that comes up over and over again.
Yes. So one of the things we always try to prove or disprove is a family story. For African-American genealogy, and for anyone really doing genealogy, oral history is kind of your foundation where you start. And then you get the records to either prove or disprove that, whether it's vital records, census records, birth, marriage, death records, wills and estates, and kind of use those to help flush out that family story.
So where did this all begin for you? You were a law student in Lansing, Michigan. What motivated you to study genealogy?
So I actually started, not like most people, I started doing my ex-boyfriend's family while I was in law school. And his family is actually from Augusta in Atlanta. So his second great aunt was Dr. Georgia DeWelly, and she had the first OBGYN clinic on Sweet Auburn Avenue for African-American women.
Wow.
Yeah, so she's pretty well known in this area. So I started my research with his family because they had an unusual surname of DeWelly. So I thought this would be something that's good to try because my name, Berry, and I thought my family, they were just farmers in upstate New York, so they were kind of boring. But I was able to find a lot of information about his family and their history here in Atlanta.
Well, you're hitting on something, too. Everybody wants to find their connection to, you know, Johnny Appleseed or to Harriet Tubman or something like
that. Right, right. Yeah, and every family has a story. What I found out later on as I started doing my family history is my family actually has a unique story. They started in Culpeper County, Virginia, where they were enslaved, and then they moved to upstate New York. What's unique about it is that a number of African Americans from Culpeper half stayed in Culpeper County and the other half moved to upstate New York.
When I read that, I was stunned because you're talking about Genesee County. I've been up there.
Yes, I
mean,
I know.
This is like way upstate.
Way upstate.
This is in western New York.
Yes.
It's almost to the Great Lakes.
It is.
And I just thought, how did all of these people, these African Americans, end up there?
So there's a story. It was interesting. It's a story of a family called the Harmon family. And so apparently after the Civil War, they saw all these African-American men that needed work. So they said that they had land that they could farm in upstate New York. So they paid for them to go to upstate, and half of the men went to upstate New York and then sent for their families. And that's how most African Americans that I'm related to got to Leroy, Caledonia, in that area.
Okay, so let's pretend we're on Genealogy Roadshow.
Okay.
What's the most notable thing about your own story?
The most notable thing about my own story.
Or what would you pick out to tell somebody?
Yeah, it's interesting, on my dad's side of the family, they were enslaved in Arkansas. And one of my ancestors died with two oil wells on his property.
In Arkansas?
In Arkansas, in about 1946. And when he died, he had no children. And his father was enslaved. So what was interesting is to find his people that could inherit, his brothers and sisters, they had to recognize these slave marriages because slaves are not allowed to get married. So because his father had two different wives because he was on two different plantations, I came from one of those lines, the Patsy line. And so my great-grandmother was able to inherit because the Supreme Court in Arkansas legitimize that marriage.
Oh, you have just opened up so many things here. You know, first of all, you know, the records, the courts, the and the traditions, and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
Now, for you, you mentioned Diwali. You know, it's a less common surname.
Mm-hmm.
Now, oftentimes slaves did not have surnames, or they just inherited the surnames of the people who enslaved them.
Well, sometimes they did, more times they didn't. So most enslaved people either chose a name, like Freeman or Freedman. If they had an unusual surname like Dwelly or Simpkins, and that was the enslaver, they took that name. But a name like Barry, Carter, or Jones, you can't assume that that was the name of the last enslaver. Mm. So a lot of times I tell people to use the Freedmen's Bureau records to find labor contracts between slaves and their former enslavers.
All right. That's an interesting thing, too, that oftentimes, you know, these people, many of these people, their lives were not thought to be worth charting or caring. Mm-hmm. But as property, it was a whole different thing.
Yes.
So what do you find in those kind of records?
So as property, there were records related to enslaved people. And a lot of those records are going to be under the enslaver, the person who owned them. And they would be listed in wills. They're in deeds. Tax records as well. So court records, a huge place to find information about enslaved people, because a lot of times if there were slave traders that had a dispute, they would actually list all the enslaved people that they bought and sold and the profits related to them. It's interesting to talk about it. And because I went to law school, I often tell people, it's not that I'm not sensitive to it, but as a lawyer, you're taught to remove emotion from a situation. So for me to be able to do the work and talk about it in such a matter-of-fact way, I can remove emotion from it. But it's still emotional to see.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at a list of human beings
yes.
treated as chattel.
Yes.
Did it feel differently when you found your relatives
it
on
did.
Those manifests?
Absolutely. It felt very different to see my family as opposed to when I'm seeing other people's families. I'm doing work for clients or for the show. So yeah, it's kind of surreal once you think about it. And sometimes I have to just step away from the computer take a walk in Santa Monica, but it is definitely work that's important, and which is why I continue to do it.
All right. You also said that this relative of yours had been, there were a couple of different marriages, and mm-hmm. that's a whole thing, too,
yes.
that families were broken apart.
Yes.
So how does that inform your looking at a family tree?
So it's interesting because you have to look at sort of the families were torn apart during the domestic slave trade. So about almost a million enslaved people were forcibly removed from the Upper South. So we think about Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, to the Lower South, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And when you're doing a family tree, it's difficult because you have to help people find their people. So you kind of go with what you know. And then DNA has actually helped in that way, with cousin matches, because typically if you're African-American doing genealogy and you get to a third cousin match, you're already into slavery. So that could be someone, for example, whose child was sold down the river, and this is now a relative of yours, but you have to figure out how you're related.
Which you found in your life, right? You
yes.
found somebody who was, second cousin?
Yes, yes. So I found people in my family history. And in doing DNA, it helped me verify the work that I was doing already, right? So I did the paper trail first, and then the DNA helped verify the cousins. And I found a bunch of other cousins. And I've been able to connect with people in upstate New York through DNA and through my research and tell them a lot about our family history and learn more about my great-grandmother who was born in Leroy.
All right, let's get to that. too. I'm speaking with Kenyatta Berry. She's co-host of the Genealogy Roadshow on PBS and also author of The Family Tree Toolkit. It's a new guide to uncovering your ancestry and researching genealogy. And Kenyatta, you write in the introduction that with dedication and work, an African-American genealogist can reconstruct the past. You are one, an African-American genealogist. Is this an expanding field?
It is. I think as the records become more available and people understand how to do the research, it definitely is an expanding field. And that's the reason, one of the reasons I wrote the book, right? Because when I started, there really wasn't a guide for kind of beginners to start out. And I think a lot of people feel for African-American genealogy, it's overwhelming. We've talked about slavery. That's something that people feel like they can't get past the 1870 brick wall. But it's an area as Ancestry, Find My Past, Family Search, and all those companies continue to expand their record set and make them available online, then it becomes easier, I think, for genealogists.
It makes me wonder how Alex Haley did it, right? When he was writing Roots 40 years ago or something like that.
Went to a lot of courthouses.
Some of the other interesting things that came up in your research, Thomas Bundy, brother of Charles, who was in your line, a cook for the Confederate Army.
Yes. So that's the thing with Thomas Bundy. This is always very, we did this on Genealogy Roadshow, it's very controversial around African Americans and their service, per
quote
se,
unquote.
Quote unquote, in the Confederate Army. But there's this story that goes with Thomas Bundy in that he was born a free person of color and in Middlesex County, Virginia. And the story goes that he was captured by an infantry in New York. And then he was made to cook for them. And then he was taken back by the Confederate in Virginia, and then captured again by New York. So this is a story that's told in upstate New York, right? And he was this honorary member, I think, of the 108th Infantry. So it was just very interesting because he died fairly young, and I don't know enough about his family, but I'm often wondering why someone, a free person of color, would even be a part of that. So he's a story that I continue to explore.
All right. So there are all these little gaps. And you warn us. You say that there will be these gaps, these people who will evade you or stories will evade you.
Yes.
How do you get to the other side of that?
Well, I mean, I also talk about your genealogy angels, right? They're people who will always help you find stuff. So one of the ways to fill in the gaps is, especially with something like Thomas Bundy, is to really kind of take that story and, you know, just tear it apart in a sense. Look at every piece of it and say, okay, is this really true? Were they, you know, were they in the same area that Thomas was in at this particular point in time, right? So you really have to take a very tactical approach, very analytical approach to kind of get to the truth and the bottom of the story. Now, sometimes you may not be able to find those records. And that's one of the things that I think people need to know going into this research. But you really have to take the story with a grain of salt and say, how can I prove or disprove this story to be true?
Mm-hmm. So there's the lawyer coming in again, removing the emotion and getting to the facts.
Yes.
And it is kind of like detective work.
It is.
An ancestor from 200 years ago lived on another continent. So let's talk about where to start. And in your toolkit, you ask people to answer some basic questions, which I get. You know, where were your parents born? Where were they married? But others, your favorite nursery rhymes, your favorite subjects in school, what smells remind you of childhood? Why do you urge us to do that?
Because that gets you to know, you get to know the person more. You know, I mean, when, you know, I was asking those questions to my mom, I was surprised with some of her answers because I just would never think about talking to her about that, right? You know, sometimes when you get into genealogy, you just get the names, dates, and places. But it's more about the person, and you want to tell their story, right? And you want to get to know more about them. Genealogy is really about storytelling and giving that ancestor a voice. Mm. And I think it's really important when you start to interview people to learn just more about them as a person. And I think it brings you much closer.
And you do point us to online resources for guidance for interviewing relatives. Are people often willing to tell the stories? I mean, I know in my family, there were a lot of secrets. You know, there was a birth not too many months after a marriage. There was a divorce and, you know, all these kind of things that just were not talked about.
Yeah. So not a lot of people some people are secretive. Let me just say that. I will say in my own family, my Berry line. So I have my mother's maiden name. And my grandfather is still alive, and I often talk about this all the time, and I tell him about it all the time. He will not give me any information on the Berry family. And my Berry family is from Macon, Georgia, and I get nothing from him. He's 93 years old. I have no idea why. I have tried and tried and tried. I said, I'm on TV. People expect me to know. But Granddad is not giving up that information. So it's been kind of difficult. A lot of times I counsel people to say, well, I really want to know for medical reasons, right? Mm-hmm. I really want to know for health reasons. And to also let people know you're not trying to find this information out because you want to expose a secret. You're finding it out for yourself, for your identity, for your own story. And kind of breaking that down so they understand you're not doing something malicious, I think kind of helps.
Yeah. And you did find that your second great-grandfather, I think it was, you thought that he was enslaved in one county, but it was actually another. How did you figure that out?
So he was in a voter registration for, I believe it was 1867, and he was in Houston County, Georgia.
So that's interesting.
Yes.
1867, you know, Reconstruction, I'm sure the first rolls of African-American voters.
Yes. So it was Lewis Kendrick. Yep. So I was pretty excited to find that. And that was something, those are available online, which is great. And I also think I've identified, which I did not write about in the book, but I think I've identified his enslaver, who was Jones Kendrick, through a will that I looked at. That took about 4 hours.
So yeah, I'm thinking of Edward Ball's book, Slaves in the Family,
yes.
Right? Who wrote about he's white man. Mm-hmm. But like, what happens to people when they find out they're, you know, whether you're related to someone who's enslaved or someone who is an enslaver? What is that emotional process like? I imagine you're part psychologist in these cases, too.
I am, yes. And I think for those whose family owned slaves or enslavers, a lot of times I've heard people say they feel shame. They feel guilt. They don't want to talk about it. And I always say, you know what? We're just trying to find our people. That's really it. We're trying to reconnect and reconstruct these family units that were torn apart. So if your family did own slaves, that was part of, you know, being very loyally. It was just what happened, right? And if you have this information, there's someone out there that's looking for it. The most difficult thing for African-American genealogy is finding the last enslaver. And if your family owned slaves and you're able to make that connection for us, then we're appreciative, right? And some people will have a negative response to it. I mean, that's going to happen. But 9 times out of 10, most people are excited that you're actually helping them find their people and reconstruct their family unit.
All right, Kenyatta Berry, please stay with us. We'd love to hear more from you. Kenyatta Berry is co-host of Genealogy Roadshow on PBS. She's also author of The Family Tree Toolkit. It's a guide to uncovering your ancestry and researching your genealogy. So we're heading into a short break, but Kenyatta, I want to note, was here for the Atlanta History Center. They had a Juneteenth celebration all throughout the weekend, and she was helping people there. Well, we're getting her on Monday morning and seeing how she can help us find our own roots. This is On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please stay with us. I'm continuing my conversation with Kenyatta Berry. She's a genealogy expert. She's co-host of Genealogy Roadshow program on PBS. She specializes in tracing African-American families, but her book, The Family Tree Toolkit, is a comprehensive guide for anyone of any ethnic background to uncover their ancestry and their family story. This is On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's keep going. Look, here is a scene from an episode of Genealogy Roadshow that you filmed in Houston.
What I also want to point out to you in this document is it says James Dearman, his mark. And you know, slaves were not allowed to read or write, but he knew how to write.
Oh my goodness, that gives so much pride. That is beautiful.
That is beautiful. Kenyatta, do you have a favorite episode of Genealogy Roadshow or a favorite discovery?
I do. And so my favorite discovery is a woman, Gail Lukasik, and she was in, I believe it was season 2 of Genealogy Roadshow. And the thing I liked about Gail's story is it kind of changed her life. Her mother was from New Orleans, was a very fair-skinned African-American woman, and then moved to Ohio, and she passed for white. And Gail's father never knew. Gail started doing research on her family and got her mom's birth certificate and realized that her mother was listed as Negro. She wrote to Louisiana. They said, this is correct. And when Gail confronted her mother denied it, but then finally said, you can't tell anyone till I die. And her mother died, and 4 months later, she was sitting across from me on Genealogy Roadshow.
Wow, powerful story.
Yeah, it's
And that's so interesting, like how she was recorded on her birth certificate, especially in a place like New Orleans, where there was so much, you know, relatively racial mixing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did Gail's DNA, and I mean, she had, you know, all of what New Orleans could offer, right? French, Spanish, and African ancestry. But her mother just chose to kind of walk away from that life. And Gail never really knew any of her relatives because her mother chose to pass.
Well, so your work is all about filling in those gaps, not just the DNA, but the real story. And one of the places that you send us to is the census.
Yes.
There's constitutional mandate beginning in 1790. Now, there's also a guide here to what kind of questions were asked on the census over time. That's fascinating to me. What kind of things are revealed in that?
Well, census records can offer you a lot of information. Obviously, the occupation of the person, of your ancestor, whether they rented or owned a farm, free of a mortgage. If they had a radio, I believe that's in 1930, they asked about that. 1940, if they lived in the same place in 1935, if they were unemployed. You know, ages, birth dates, different things like that. But the census, I do caution with census records, you will find inconsistencies with ages all the time. All the time. Someone will be 50 in 1920 and then they're 65 in 1930. I don't know what happens, but just be cautious about that.
Well, you also give guides to state census and but also to look at family Bibles and vital records and court records, obituaries and prayer cards. Now, I'm somebody who just cleaned out a barn full of stuff, and I had been, because I had a whole bunch of space, I was the inheritor for my family. And I have to tell you, I looked at these things and I thought, okay, Marie Kondo would say I have to throw these out. But what do you keep?
Well, I think you keep obituaries. I mean, I really like them. My cousin upstate New York that I just met a couple of years ago, her mom kept a bunch of obituaries, and she thought it was morbid. And when I went to visit her, I was like, bring out that box, okay, because I want to see this. So I think you keep obituaries. You keep the family heirlooms. I always tell people to make sure you digitize things that you have, if you can, and keep them in a safe so that it don't get damaged by, you know, natural disasters or anything like that. But also just recording those family stories is super important as well.
Well, so much is revealed about American history, too, that, you know, court records, for example, these were real centers of communities.
Absolutely. Yes. The courthouse. If you're not in a burned county, and burned counties are there are a lot of them.
So. Yeah. When did that happen, the Burn Counties? Was it a civil war period?
A lot of it was during the Civil War, and some just happened, you know, just by accident. But if you have a burned county, most more than likely during the Civil War, then those records, especially as it relates to wills and estates and different court records, for especially for African Americans, they won't exist. So there's some other census substitutes and different things you can do to get through burned counties. There's a whole section on that, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. But the courthouse was the center of where all the action took place, right? Where everything was recorded. And that's why, and a lot of those records have not been digitized. So it's important to go to the county courthouse to plan
a trip. Okay, so this is what you did. You went to places, you went to Culpeper County, you went to upstate New York. And there's also, I had no idea there was such a vast repository digitally of sites for people who'd been imprisoned or who'd been in trouble. Kind of a fascination with that.
Yes, there is. It's funny. I was actually just working with some of those records. And so on Ancestry, they do have records for Texas and California. So you can see the state prison registries. You can see what they were charged with, their sentence, if they died in prison, how they died. I mean, it's fascinating because you kind of look at it and you can see some repeat offenders if you start doing research and you think, this person lived to be 70, but when they were 20, they were in and out of jail, you know, in their 20s. So it's just fascinating to learn more about the person. They started to come to life.
Yeah. I just talked to a guest a couple of weeks ago. You know, his family had all thought that they were, you know, related to Daniel Boone, but he found that there were horse thieves and, you know, drunkards and, you know, the way that we sort of, the stories we carry, as you were saying earlier. But there is also a really interesting distinction here that I hadn't thought about between pre-1820 records and post-1820 records. What's going on there? What happened in history?
Well, there was obviously, a lot of times there were changes in which the information that they collected, right? So, different changes in laws, different things related to immigration. So they started to collect more information post 1820, right? And then you also got to think of the record set pre 1820, right? You're getting into colonial research. That's a little bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. A lot of those records are going to be in societies and places like the New England Historic Genealogical Society, New York Genealogical and Biographical Society. So some of those records are a little bit more difficult to access and to analyze. And especially in the work that I do, I often don't get back that far. I mean, the oldest person I've gotten in my family is my fifth great grandmother, who was born in 1800. But even getting more on her is a tad bit difficult. So when you're doing this research, it's important to understand the laws at the time. That's why being a lawyer comes in handy, because those laws impact the information that was collected on the census, the information that was collected as far as immigration was concerned, and different things at the courthouse, laws related to free people of color, slavery, everything. The laws govern, you know, America, it governs our society. So it's important to know the laws of the state you're researching.
Well, and also a lot of people were in colonial America because they were sent there. It was a penal colony for the most part.
Yeah, and they were indentured servants. So there's records.
Tell me more about indentured servants.
So indentured servants typically came here, someone paid their way, and then they had a term of servitude, typically 7 years on average. Some were less, and when you're a indentured servant, there should be a contract, and I give some resources for that, and you were to work off that payment of your way and housing and all of that within that time period, and then you were able to, you know, go on and work on your own, get your own farm, and build your life in America. So there were some, both, you know, there were some Africans that came as indentured servants as well. Very few, but some that did. And so those records are available, as I said, at other societies, as well as Family Search, I believe, has some stuff too.
There's some interesting, if you're of Native American descent, and that's another interesting thing.
Yes.
A lot of people in the Southeast claim to be of Native American descent. First of all, why is that?
Well, everyone wants to be Native American, actually. It's not just in the Southeast. Okay. I always make
the joke. Is that right?
Yeah. I always make the joke that when I was, I remember we did an episode of Genealogy Roadshow, and this woman was sitting in front of me, and she's very pale skinned. And she had freckles and red hair, and she says, "I'm Native American." And I was like, "No, you're not. You're not. I don't even need to look at your DNA." But I don't understand. I think it's just it's one of those stories. Everyone always tells me that they've heard that they're Native American. And I think it's just something that's been passed down. It's typically, oh, she had the high cheekbones and she used to wear hair, two braids. I had this whole thing in my family, right? And I don't have any Native American ancestry. But it's that story that's been carried down for some reason. And I think a lot of it, one thing that most people don't know is that Native Americans actually owned slaves. So the Cherokee, and I talk a little bit about that in the book, and those same enslaved folks walked the Trail of Tears with the Native Americans when they're making their way out west.
Kenyatta Berry is my guest. She's a lawyer, she's a television personality, and author of The Family Tree Toolkit, which we're talking about right now. Okay, so you've just reminded me of something in the book. The Georgia Land Lotteries.
Mm-hmm.
This is a direct affront, I guess, to Native American ancestry. What was that? When did that happen?
So there were several. There's probably about seven different land lotteries, I think. And I first discovered the Georgia Land Lotteries because George Henry Dwelly, who I started my research with, his father, C.J. Cook, was a white man, Caleb J. Cook, from Massachusetts, and he participated in one of the Georgia Land Lotteries, and that's how he got his land. And then at some point, he acquired George's mother, Mary Thomas, and they had a child, George Henry Dwelly. And those are only two enslaved people that he had, that he owned during his lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And so the land lotteries were really people taking opportunity to come out here and farm and build sort of a new life. And it was interesting, him being from Massachusetts, to come to Georgia to kind of start that life and then have enslaved people.
Yeah, so, and it, like the Homesteading Act later,
yes, exactly.
Right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, like the Homesteading Act later. And it was kind of the opening up, you know, you see the opening up of the West, right, with the removal of the Native Americans to the West. You see the growth in, and that's in Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, where people start to come and build plantations, right? And they start to move the enslaved people from the Upper South to the Lower South. And that all happens in the 1830s.
Right. And so after the Trail of Tears, all of this
all
land
of
is available.
All this land is available. And people start to come and say, well, you know, cotton is king. So we're going to do a plantation. And cotton required was hard work. And so a lot of the enslaved people died early on. so they needed more, so they would just come and build plantations. You see, if you do research, you see a lot of people coming from the Carolinas really into this area, and especially Alabama and Mississippi.
So you're learning a lot about America. We get a few civics lessons, certainly, in this book.
Yes.
Learn how court systems work, that kind of thing, vital records, and mm-hmm. how they all fold into this sense of a society building at different stages. What did you learn about American history as you're looking at this?
A lot.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I really wasn't a history buff until I started doing genealogy. And I wanted to know more about what was going on at that time. And I was surprised. My biggest chapter, one of my biggest chapters, is immigration and naturalization. I remember writing the book in 2016. I was just devouring like all this information on all the different immigration laws. And I wrote the book in a way that I wanted people to not only understand how to do genealogy, but to learn something, to understand how their ancestors fit within history. And for me, it was interesting to learn about a lot of immigration laws, but also I did a big portion of my book on Confederate pension records. So that was very interesting because in Mississippi, there are actually African Americans who have pensions.
For serving in the Confederate Army.
Yeah, for being a part of it, whether you're building something, but they actually have pension records. And I think a lot of people don't know that. And those records are available online. So that was very interesting because you start to understand kind of more about the Civil War, more about history and how your family fits into American history. Mm. And so I find it really fascinating. I wanted to make sure that folks learned a little while they're doing their research.
So I'm wondering if somebody gets started with, you said you did the paperwork first, then the DNA
yes.
test.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people do begin with the DNA
they
test
do.
And
yeah.
that piques their interest. Now, people have helped solve cold cases and crimes
yes.
with DNA tests. But there are also families who are reluctant. So what's your advice to somebody who wants to search their family roots but doesn't really trust putting their his or her DNA out there?
Well, I would say start the traditional way. Just start with the paper. Start with the census records. Start with the vital records. And vital records are going to be your birth, marriage, and your death records. One thing to consider when you're looking at death records, I always say they're only as good as the informant. Okay, so the person who was given the information at that time of death, they may not know the person's name. I mean, just before I came on, I was looking at the death record for Reverend George Henry Dwelly. His daughter gave his father's name as J.E. Dwelly. Okay, mm-hmm. I know from research in an interview that he said who his father was, C.J. Cook. So just right there, you can see how those records are only as good as the informant. But start with the traditional paperwork. And that way, you don't have to give your DNA to someone, but you're still finding out about your ancestors and telling their story.
What are some common mistakes you notice people making when they're just starting out on their own genealogy roadshow?
The most common one, and I am guilty of it myself, is citing your sources. Please cite your sources. Where did you get this information from? Was it from your great aunt? Was it your grandmother or your mother? Was it from this document? Cite your sources as much as you can, because when you go back to that tree, you're going to wonder years later, where did that come from? So I think that's the biggest mistake. And I also think another mistake is attaching your tree, if you have a tree online, to someone else's tree.
What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is, for example, on Ancestry, you have a tree on Ancestry.com. Someone else has a family tree on Ancestry. And they pop up and say, oh, these two trees match.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will just take that information from that second tree as fact.
Uh-huh.
But you don't know that person. You don't know if they cited their sources. You don't know where they got that information. And I find a lot of times my clients do that as well. But then
that could be a fake news tree.
Yes, absolutely. And what happens is you take those mistakes and you put them in your tree, right? So there's, you know, children being born after the father has died and just dates and things that are wrong. So just don't attach to someone's tree unless you know that person, but do the research on your own so you can have the proof to tell that story.
We have just half a minute left, but, you know, there's just this powerful scene of you going to the home in upstate New York of mm-hmm. your great, 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 mm-hmm. great, three greats? I can't remember.
My great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather.
Three greats, yeah.
The home is still intact, and you walk in and you see it. I mean, and you can imagine them there. What has this brought to your life? You know, this concept of
yeah.
where people were and the lives that they lived.
You know, it's been great. For me, it's the upstate New York connection is that I've been able to build that bridge. So my great-grandmother was born in upstate New York and moved to Detroit, where I was born, my mother and my grandmother were born. When she died in 1983, we really didn't have that connection to my cousin. So being able to go there and have that connection to that family and tell those family stories and share the information with them has really changed my life. And it's brought, made it very rich for me to know that I've stepped in their footsteps and, you know, kind of given them a voice and been able to tell their stories when they've been lost to history.
All right. So, Kenyatta Barry, thank you so much for speaking with us. She's co-host of Genealogy Roadshow on PBS, also author of The Family Tree Toolkit, a guide to uncovering your ancestry and researching genealogy. We did get a tweet from Laura on Twitter looking for suggestions for white people trying to locate ancestors of slaves that are family-owned. That is all in the book as well.
It is.
This is all we have time for at the moment. Well, we do thank you so much for joining us for On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. See you tomorrow.